Hello, everybody, and episode welcome to...
Ava just confidently proclaimed, I'll do the intro for this one, it will be fine, and then proceeded to serve you that.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 222nd episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast about board games, dice games, card games, finger games, hand games, word games, and some other games that I haven't even discovered yet. Just imagine the games that we don't even know about. I am joined today by someone who I do know about, and that is Tom Brewster.
Hello, I'm knowable.
He is so damn knowable, and that's what I know about him. I am Ava Foxford, and I am here today to help us both talk to you about some board games that we have absolutely played, except actually that's not true. I've played none of them, but only technically. We are going to be talking about Findorf, a game that I think that I want Tom to send me in the post, but he probably wants to save himself some admin and convince me that it's not good.
That's it's a little podcast metagame.
Next, and this is going to be the meat of the episode as far as I'm concerned, because I'm really quite excited to hear more about Beyond the Sun, Leaders of the New Dawn, which is the expansion to a game that I've been playing quite a lot of recently, and remembering that I really, really, really like it. Is the expansion going to make that better? Is it going to be exciting? I don't know. I hope that Tom doesn't like it so that he'll send it to me and then I play it and I do like it. So it needs to be that exact thing for me, but maybe that's weird. Maybe it's not all about me. Finally, we're going to talk a little preview talk possibly about a thing that is probably getting a video quite soon, which is
very
the game
soon
that I've not heard anything about, but it is called Beast.
Great name. 10 out of 10 name. And I'm not going to say 10 out of 10 game, but it's an interesting game and it's getting a review. So it's pretty good.
This is good. I'm excited about this because you said that this is like hidden movement, secret role type thing. And I actually played Not Alone again recently. And I'd forgotten how much of a banger that game is. So like, I'm hoping to reference that again maybe later so that I have something that I can input in this episode where I've not played things.
I'm really excited to talk to you about Beast because I think that it does enough stuff that's going to make you excited about it, even if you haven't played it. That's the tease for the end of the episode.
That's a good tease. That's a good tease.
You got to slog through all this rubbish before you get to that, though. Let's go!
Everybody at home, I just want to warn you that Tom told me that the intro here might be tedious.
Ava, I'm going to tell you about a game called Findorf. This is a game from Friedman Fries, the designer known for making Power Grid mostly, but also known for every single one of his games, starting with the letter F and being green. And this is a game about his hometown, Findorf, which is one of the 23 districts of Bremen. Ava, I have never been more sold by the back of a box. And I'm going to just read you, straight up read you, the back of the box from Findorf to the tune of some sort of dramatic music in the background.
Can I also just say, Friedman Fries likes the letter F enough that he made both of his names begin with it and he made sure that he was born in a town that began with it.
Unbelievable scenes. Findorf, the hometown game from Friedman Fries. Raise the important structures of Findorf, one of the 23 districts of Bremen, the hometown of Friedman Fries. Findorf has three Fs and is named after Jürgen Christian Findorf, 1720 to 1792, who was responsible for draining and surveying the bog in the north of Bremen, for extracting its peat, and for populating the bog with residents. Your focus is on raising the right combination of the 25 historical structures from the period of 1803 to 1916. Do you raise the reed chair factory, or the slaughterhouse to gain a lot of thalers, or smaller structures like schools, the beer hall, or the peat skipper shelter to win the game in small steps? You can even profit from the high mortality rate of this period by running a cemetery. Only by adapting your strategy to your structures will you honour Mr. Findorf and win the game when the roadbed to Hamburg is finished.
I think I've got a little tear in my eye at this point. Like, that was that was beautiful. That was beautiful.
So that back of that box, right? I think if you're going to do dry games, you need to make them this specific and strange because I love it when a game does this.
I'm really, really, really excited for this now. Like, from starting with the first fact about Findorf being that it's got three Fs in it.
which you can see by the name of the game.
It's beautiful. Also, I quite like the fact that, like, there's the implication that it took them, like, 113 years to build 25 buildings, which is like less than a building every 4 years. And like, I think I could beat that on my own.
I also love that there's an implication that Jürgen Christian Findorf populated the entire bog himself. What a game.
I can't tell whether Friedman Fries loves or hates his hometown from that. There's so much going on here. This is wonderful.
And it was a great lead into a game that is very dry and quite boring, but also quite fun. Let me tell you about it. So Findorf is a strange little Euro game where all you're going to be doing is one of four actions. It's a really simple little action selection mechanism where you pick up your little worker and you choose one of the four actions for him to do this turn. Here are your actions. Number one, purchase. It's the biggest, most complicated action in the game. This will let you upgrade your other actions, so you can choose to upgrade any of the four actions, so when you do them later, you'll do them even more. But you can also upgrade things that are going to get you stuff like bricks and rails and peat, which are the resources in the game. This is also the action that lets you raise those 25 structures we talked about. These are cards that you keep in your hand, and they're going to be the things that will alter your strategy, that will confer like weird bonuses on you, but they're a bit expensive. But in a fun twist, they'll cost you less if you build them in the historically correct year. We'll get more details on those a little bit later on. The other three actions are incredibly simple. Hiring means you can get more workers, these little pieces that you can put on your factories, which then you will activate in production, where you assign your workers to any of the factories you have in front of you to produce the things like bricks and rails and peat, the main resources in the game. And then your last option is to sell. You can sell the peat that you've produced to this sort of universal peat market for money. You can sell rails to build a big railroad that will get you points and is also the end game timer. Or you can build houses for your workers, which I'll get back to in just a second. So this is a really simple slate of four possible actions that you can upgrade throughout the course of the game, but it's punctuated by this bureaucracy step. The actions are actually on this little loop. So when you choose an action, you sort of move it a number of steps based on, you know, the next action you want to get to. And every so often you'll go through this bureaucracy step and then perform bureaucracy, which is where your houses are going to guzzle peat from the market to fuel them. Your workers and your houses, if you've got combinations, if you've got one worker and one house, they'll magically combine into a piece of rail. They'll do that every turn. I don't exactly know why. And then at the end of the bureaucracy step, one of your workers will die of old age. So you need to continually replenish them. And in this game, my friend Harry had the cemetery, so he was just rubbing his hands with glee every single time a pensioner popped their clogs. Bizarre game. The twist here, the obvious big twist, is those buildings, and they're going to like wrinkle your strategy and vary it up from game to game. So every player is going to get dealt a certain number of buildings, and in a fun variant, you draft those buildings at the start of the game, which I think could be really cool. And then those buildings are going to get you like weird little bonuses. So maybe the cemetery, which will earn you points for dead workers. Maybe you have a really, I just bought this incredibly expensive building very early on, but it then gave me little drip income every round, so it sort of paid for itself when I built it at the right time. You can build things like the slaughterhouse, which will then add extra bits of rail onto the track, meaning the game goes on a little bit longer. Or you could do something like build the reed chair factory, whose bonus was so boring, I've completely forgotten what it was. It's a weird little game, because one of the things I was really surprised by is how fast it plays. Really, really simple actions means that it sort of like pops around the table very, very quickly. You can plan like a few turns ahead at all times, so it's kind of procedural in a weird way. And I had a nice time with it. I just didn't know if I loved it. And Ava, I think we can maybe get some of your Friedman Fries expert Fries. I was trying to combine expertise and Fries there. Didn't really work.
Expert Fries. Here's the thing. Expert Fries. Friedman.
Expert Fries. A frisson of expert Fries. Yes. I like Findorf. I had a really pleasant time with it. But I don't think it has the... I think it's a little bit weird. It's a little bit Friedman Fries. But it's not quite as like fringe and odd as something like Fayum. You played Fayum, right?
Yeah, I really, really, really love Fayum.
I really, really liked it as well. And I actually, playing Findorf reminded me how much I loved that game. And I might have to go back to it. Because there's hints of that weirdness in this game. There's hints of you constructing an engine and then juicing it in a really weird way to score a bunch of points and kind of go a little bit off the rails. But Fiam just sort of felt a little bit absurd in a way that this doesn't. And I think I'm sort of looking for that in these odd Freeman Freeze games these days. And for people who don't know, you can go back and listen to, I don't remember what episode it is, just search Fiam on shutupandsitdown.com and you'll get right there. But that was a game where you had a really strange little cycling deck system where you would redraw cards at the top of your discard pile to build these various like networks in an ancient Egyptian hex board. Very hard to explain, but really, really interesting, fascinating design that I don't know if Findorff quite scratched the same itch as, but it was nippy and fun and a bit strange.
Yeah, it's definitely one of these things with Freedman Freeze where like you always end up with a bit of curiosity about anything that he makes because the themes could be really, really bland or the mechanics might be really, really weird. The art will be coherent and possibly not great, but you know that things are going to be clear and there's going to be something there that is unusual, but you don't know whether there's going to be something there that's going to be really good. And that's a risky place to step into, I think. And so I always get excited when I see one of his box covers. And I could not tell you which of his games, I don't know, you can't say without playing it whether it's any good. And sometimes you can't even say after playing it whether it's any good. I've had people bounce off Fiam completely. And I've had people be like, oh my God, this is amazing. And yeah, just about every reaction in between. It's a strange one. He's a strange designer. I'm quite curious about this and I really do quite want to look at it just because it does sound boring. But then if you're telling me that if there isn't a spicy, interesting action in it, like the thing with Fiam is it's a deck builder where you're only allowed to take certain of your cards back from your discard pile and it costs you money to take any more. So you've got to be really, really clever with your hand management to do things in the right order so you can get the right cards back. And that is so wrinkly in and of itself, even before you bring in the fact that everything that's built on the board belongs to the Pharaoh and not to you as a player, which means that other people will be using your stuff. It actually, if you go back to last episode and think about Hamlet, Fiam is probably the game that is much less accessible, much less cozy than Hamlet, but offers so much more spice from some of the same ideas and challenges, just in a more complicated, weirder, spicier kind of version. I will also say, Fiam, if you are going to look back for that episode, it's spelled F-A-I-Y-U-M, which is impossible to tell from someone saying it out loud. So if you are going to search for it, that's how you spell it. I'm not going to spell it again. You can rewind.
I definitely think that Freeman Freeze is a designer where he's at his best and worst when he's most experimental, in that like Fiam is a game that people really like either click into or very much bounce off because it is super weird. And that's even true of games like Power Grid, even maybe his most like respected and vaunted title. I just didn't click with at all. I found that weird and paralyzing in a way that I couldn't quite, you know, get into. So I think that the thing that's most strange about Findorff is that it's sort of, it doesn't feel like a concession to people wanting less weirdness in its game. It just feels a little safer. And I think that means it's a game that, for me, shoots down the middle in a way that I'm not entirely like that fond of. But for some people, it might be the Freedman Freeze game they really enjoy because it's slick and it's fast and it's pacey and it's presented really well and it's got some kind of funny, odd details about it that make it kind of quirky, but not so quirky in a way that becomes grating, like in something like Fiam, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like I think that Fiam is definitely, some of the times you put it in front of people, they're going to go, what on earth is going on? Can you stop, please? Whereas it sounds like this might be less likely to generate that, but also less likely to generate people like me who see it and go like, wow, this might be the most interesting way that I've burnt my brain in ages.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that something about this game, like I showed it to my friends and they looked at the presentation and went, oh no, thinking that I was going to put them in front of a really weird game. And then sort of all quite pleasantly surprised by the fact that it wasn't as weird as they thought. And then towards the end, a little bit maybe disappointed that it wasn't as weird and interesting as they thought.
Yeah.
So it's a strange game. It sits in the middle in a lot of ways. I enjoyed my time with it. I wouldn't necessarily say to seek it out, but I'd play it if someone asked me to play it. I liked it.
Yeah, I'm never going to stop wanting to like dip into any opportunity I have to dive into the parallel universe that Friedman Friesen lives in, where board games didn't really... I don't know. I can't explain what it is. He does feel like he's come from a parallel universe and is just showing us a total other history of Euro games where just his particular interests and quirkiness. Like, we always highlight the green hair and the green boxes and the F, and the fact that he counts the number of Fs there are in any town that he visits and, like, tells you that as the first thing. Oh, London, it's crap. Absolutely no Fs. Why would you bother? All of these things like point to a kind of like eccentrism. And I think that that is actually really appropriate because the games have an eccentrism. And like, I will always be interested in Fast Sloths. I really liked. I don't think it was like the most exciting thing, but I thought it was so simple and funny in some ways. And like, that Fresh Fish game is a game that like absolutely broke my brain, despite just being tile laying and root building within some tile laying on a grid. And Power Grid, I love and hate about equally, and will always enjoy feeling that anger as I play it and remember that I can't do basic arithmetic. And yeah, it's just plowing a furrow, and I want him to keep at it. You keep going, Friedman Frieser. Friedman Frieser.
This is a inspirational pod moment directed only at Friedman.
Only one person. We want an audience of one. If everyone could have like just looked away for a while during that,
yeah,
so that you didn't see that little motivational speech on this podcast. Yeah, that's great. What should we talk about next, Tom? Shall we go Beyond the Sun?
That's the title of... That's what a coincidence. That's the title of the next game that I want to talk about on this podcast, Ava. Except it's not even a game. It's an expansion. Wow. So I've been having a little dabble. This is a Rio Grande double bill. We talked about Findorf, published by Rio Grande. And now we're talking about Beyond the Sun's expansion, Leaders of the New Dawn, designed by Dennis K. Chan and Joseph Summer and published by Rio Grande Games. If you don't know what Beyond the Sun is, it's a game that we're quite fond of. It is a big old Euro game that is based around the concept of what if a tech tree was a whole game? You have this big sprawling tech tree that's in the middle of the table. You're going to sort of gently evolve over the course of the game, starting with very simple techs and then ascending the rungs of this ladder until you're doing more and more complicated actions on two boards. You've got this one big tech tree board, and on the other side, you have a little galaxy board where you're doing a bit of area control, a bit of doing space. It's a really good mix between a sort of dry, solid Euro game with a little bit of spice and player interaction that makes it really quite special, really quite fun. It's got a video review. You can check it out on shutupandsitdown.com, YouTube/shutupandsitdown, Beyond the Sun video, please. Easy recommend. It's worth playing. But Ava, they've made an expansion for Beyond the Sun.
Nobody told me that.
It's called Leaders of the New Dawn, and I am going to break down what is in this box, and I'm going to do a really bad job of doing it in a way that you'll see why in a second. Here are the little modules that you have in Leaders of the New Dawn. It's a very simple, small box add-on for Beyond the Sun, people who've played it lots and want some more. It adds a solo mode. Have I played the solo mode? I have not. I thought about doing this, but then I also thought that it's not something that I would do normally. I very rarely play solo games, and so I felt like covering a solo expansion for a game that I wouldn't play in a solo mode anyway felt a bit strange to someone who doesn't really dabble in them anyway. I wouldn't know how to judge it. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I think there is something of, like, I recently tried Oranienburger Canal, and, like, I really wanted to put it in front of some people, and then I was like, oh, do you know what? It's got a solo mode. I wonder if it's okay. And it, like, really won me over in its solo mode. And I think that there's something to know if you're someone who doesn't like solo modes and you kind of have to play one for your job, and you end up being like, oh, that was really nice. So Maybe, but no, because you didn't do it. So don't, yeah, you don't have to do that, Tom. We're just going to talk about it on a podcast. It's fine.
Yeah. Make me sound better at my job. Thank you. I feel like my baseline of solo modes is like, because it's that oddity, I feel like I'll just enjoy it regardless. And then I feel like people who play loads of solo modes will think I have bad taste in solo modes.
Oh.
So I'm just going to avoid it by not commenting.
That's fair.
And hope that there's someone out there who's a solo player who can tell everyone what they think about Beyond the Sun's solo mode. The other thing that it adds is some new tech, Ava. Some new tech cards to put in your tech tree. And it changes some old techs for balance reasons. And guess what? Surprise, surprise. This is also something that I don't entirely know how to talk about. Because I'm not a guy who deep dives on strategy. I don't know the implications of changing two rock into one rock. I'm an idiot boy, and I'm a bit silly. So I don't know anything about that. The new techs, the entire new techs, are fun and a little bit weird and add some needed variety into the game. But the balanced ones, I don't know what's going on there. Don't ask me. I'm very confused.
Ask me. I've played a bit too much with some Board Game Arena, and like, I have seen the updated texts that were available on Board Game Arena, which means that I know about at least one card that has been like reduced in strength quite a lot. And it was my favorite card in the game. And then I realized that it was just because I was winning every time I got it. And so I am kind of glad that it got reduced in power, because I think it is one of those things that did become, with lots of play, a little bit overmuch. And I think that that might be where they got the data from for updating the cards.
I see.
Because the updated cards, the updated techs showed up on Board Game Arena quite a long time ago. And I suspect it's in response to seeing that there was some stuff. And that is what I kind of want to know with updated texts, is like, have they been tested with a lot of people who know the game enough to be like, yeah, that's meaningfully good? And does it not reduce the fun? That card, I still think, is one of the more powerful cards in the game. It's the mass cloning card. But it has been reduced in power, and it has been made so you have to work a little bit harder to get the most out of it. And I think that is actually real sweet spot card engineering. I haven't noticed any other of the card changes in the updated text, because I don't look at them often enough to think about that. Oh, I think I did. Yeah, I've seen one, but I'm not going to talk about it because I don't know enough about it. But updated text, I think they're probably good. I don't think you need them to play the game and have fun with it, because our review, every game that I've played in person has been with the other text. And maybe I have to force myself not to take the card that I love if I'm teaching people. And that's all that I would say about it, is it's just like, people won't notice why that's so good until they know the game a bit more.
I've played a whole bunch.
And
so
in a game like this, it's so dependent on that stuff. And it is that was a level 2 tech card, so it can shift the game quite early on. I think I'm quite glad that it got that little debuff. So, that's my little boring updated cards segment.
That's good, because I had nothing to say about minor updates to cards. And also, disappointingly, I actually don't have that much to say about the new factions either. There's 2 new faction boards they've added into the game, 2 new variants that you can mess around with in terms of who you're playing as. In brief, one of them is just really good at making loads of ships. They're quite aggressive, good at spewing out lots of little ships on that area control board for a playstyle that's going to be about colonizing loads of stuff really quickly. The other faction actually has a very interesting gimmick that kind of reminds me more of TI than anything else. Well, the other faction has to predict which achievements are going to get completed in this game, and they get bonus points if those predictions come true, which I think is really interesting as a challenge for players who've played a lot of Beyond the Sun, to look at the board state, to look at the other achievements, to look at who's playing and sort of pin their tail on the exact space donkey that they think is going to win this space horse race. Very strange little factions. Nice, good variety, good spice. But let's get to the meat of what this expansion adds, which is the leaders. So this is the big sort of flashy new module that isn't in the base game at all. It's not a solo mode. It's not the new tech. It's not a new faction. It's an entirely new system, which is, at the start of the game, you are going to draft 2 leaders, a blue leader and a red leader. The leaders have really simple, really small powers. Very like, you know, there's one of mine just like got me to upgrade some ships a little bit. There are powers that only like trigger at the very start of the game. They are all minor little adjustments, nothing huge and swingy here. But they really do change the game in a way that I think is shows you how clean and balanced Beyond the Sun is as a proposition. It's such a balanced ecosystem that even these slight changes afforded by leaders will absolutely ramp up that early game so that you're firing on all cylinders so much faster than you normally would be. So in our game that we played, we were like at that mid-game stage where you have like lots of resources and are managing more than like two rocks and a person. Way quicker. We had a much punchier, shorter game because the on-ramp into the interesting decisions is so much faster. And I think this is something of a concession to people who have played lots of Beyond the Sun who find that early game a little bit rote at this point. Yeah. There's a few sort of setup actions in Beyond the Sun where your sort of early turns are kind of like predictable and played out. And I think having the leaders in the game means that people will have more diverging paths at the start where their effects are felt most, and they don't necessarily mess up the really solid mid and end game in Beyond the Sun.
Whoa! Hold the phone there, cowboy. Me and Ava recorded this podcast without looking at the price of the Beyond the Sun expansion, which is somewhere between like 30 and 45 quid in lots of places for just a deck of cards and some player boards. That's a whole bunch of money. It doesn't change our opinions on the quality of what's on offer here, right? But for the price of a new, reasonably substantial game, you must ask if it's worth it for you. It may or it may not be. I think this price personally makes something that I wouldn't recommend unless you've played a whole bunch of Beyond the Sun. If it's getting loads of play, if it's one of your favourites, absolutely. But that price does make it a really hard sell if you're not getting this game out all that often. That's all I've got to say, and now you can get on with the rest of the podcast. Bye.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes loads of sense, and that sounds really exciting, and I'm actually quite up for that. One of my favourite expansions... One of my favorite expansions is the Terraforming Mars Prelude expansion, which is that sort of thing, like maybe like a little bit more than that, but it just gives you two cards at the beginning of the game. You'll get, I think you choose from three or four and you get two cards, and they will just give you a little leg up in one place and like one extra symbol or one extra thing or a little bit more money or a little bit less money, but some more production of something. And it is perfect because it's not so complicated that you can't play it with new people who have just learned the game. It gives new people a little bit of a jump on the more interesting version of the game. Yes. So you don't have to do the beginner pass because people already have a route that they are doing. And it shaves about half an hour off the game, which is a game that is about half an hour too long in its standard form. So it just makes the whole thing svelter, and it manages to take out the most boring half hour by far, because it's the one where you're able to do the least, and it just means you'll be able to do a little bit more in those early turns, and that is enough to mean that you get to the interesting bit quicker and get to the end quicker. And that sort of thing, I think, is a really, really smart move if it's done well. And it sounds like this is a module that lands.
Yeah, I really think it does land. I think that I would see this as this sort of like, It's a really like sort of sharp injection of sort of life into this game. And that's not to say that the game lacked it before. Like, we've played lots of Beyond the Sun. We really, really like it as a box. But I think that if you've played lots of it, this is exactly the right kind of thing that will kind of just juice the game enough to keep it on your shelf, keep it interesting, keep it fresh. And I'll say as well, when we did the review, at the time, there were a lot of rumblings about what the expansion would be. And I think the expansion was going to be out. I think I say in the video that there was a prediction it was going to be out by like the end of the year or something from the publisher. And we blew past that. It's a long time later. And now the expansion is coming out. And it's also smaller than I think was what was predicted in that video, what was shared in that video from the publisher to us. So it's a smaller expansion that's taken longer to make. And I'm so glad that that's the case, because I think what Beyond the Sun, it doesn't need Cosmic Encounter style flashy leaders that do crazy things. It doesn't need loads of new stuff. It just needs those little tweaks to the ecosystem that keep it a little bit, you know, give it that little bit of friction, give it that little bit of tension, give it something new. Very, very on board for this as just like a little pellet of cards that are going to just fundamentally shake up this really, like, again, I keep referring to it as this, but like a really balanced ecosystem.
Yeah.
A game that is so tuned and so perfect that even these very slight changes really, really mess with the shape of the game in ways that are, yeah, you can see them if you're a beginner, and you can see them if you played a whole bunch of the game. Yeah. Really cool stuff.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I've played a lot of it. And I also, like, I think the last game I played, I realized that there was like a whole nother approach to something that got unlocked by a particular set of cards coming out. And like, I got pushed away from what I would usually do. And I tried to do that. And it was like, oh, wow, there's so much going on with that. And it was like, oh, wow, how does this still have that sort of stuff in it? And that means that anything that is going to nudge me down a slightly different path, even if it wasn't also updating text and making more variants in it, that's really cool. I think from the sound of it, the only thing that I'm not too hype about there being a solo mode, although I might play it just because I think I've played enough of it that I could like quickly say whether this is enough to make me be excited about it. But
yeah,
I don't know. I think that the problem is that the puzzle of it is made so much more interesting by trying to describe what you are building and the narrative side of it to the people at the table. So I'm a bit worried that that wouldn't come across as much in a solo game, but I'd like to give it a go. Then
yeah,
the only thing that I'm really worried about is the, or not worried about, but just like not fussed about, is the faction boards, because like I've never really played with the back faction boards. Like I think I've once or twice used the like extended versions of the faction boards where it like has slightly more asymmetry, because they've always just looked a bit like, I don't really want to spend more time looking at my own player board to work out what I've got to do next. I'm more excited by, and this is a theme that keeps on coming up in podcasts, I'm more excited by what's going on in the middle of the table that everyone is looking at. And I want there to be more of that in this game rather than more of looking down at myself. So having two extra faction boards, like, that's fine. That's okay. Yeah. I'm sure that's good. But that's the bit that I'm not excited about. But all of the rest of it, a few more tech cards is well appreciated. A little bit more balance and clarity, so that nobody ever feels like they've just took the wrong path and someone else got lucky.
I think there's a couple more event cards in there as well. So there's a little bit more variance in what events can appear to.
Yeah.
But again, like not much. If you get this expansion, you've got to be prepared that it's literally like a very small deck of cards, two player boards, and a solo manual, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
But it's appropriate for this game. It's what this game needs. It's an expansion that suits Beyond the Sun. Big fan of it.
Yeah.
Two thumbs up. If you've played a whole bunch of Beyond the Sun, go for it. It's definitely not a necessary expansion if you've only played like a game of Beyond the Sun. See how much you play and then go from there, I reckon.
Yeah, sounds good. Beast mode. Tom is going into beast mode. Beast.
I can't really do a very good scary beast impression. I'm not a scary person. I'm just a normal man.
Can you try?
Ah!
This is interesting because I actually didn't hear most of that noise because we're talking over Discord and that
I'll put a funny noise in instead. Yeah. That's what I'll do.
Yeah.
Ava, I want to tell you about Beast because it's a really cool, weird little game that we're going to be reviewing pretty soon.
Ooh.
So Beast is a first-time design from Studio Midhall, and it is a game, it's a hidden movement game, basically. It's a hidden movement game where multiple players are going to be hunters and one player is going to be a beast. That beast could be one of many different genres. It could be a big wolf called Fangrir. It could be a big frog called Bolgin. Or it could be a big hog called Hogbad. Excellent naming there. 10 out of 10. Well done, Studio Midhall, for your silly little creatures. In this game, the hunters are hunting the beast. It's a hidden movement game where the beast is going to be stalking around the woods, eating sheep, preying on local wildlife, and the hunters are trying to stop the beast from doing that. It's set in this kind of like oldie sort of, it kind of looks, it's kind of Nordic and mystical. It kind of looks foggy and boggy, and all the cards are very hazy and impressionistic. It's got lovely art. You need to have a look at this game if you haven't already, if you're listening to this pod, to get a good idea of what Beast looks like, because it's gorgeous. Just don't do it while you're driving or something like that. That'd be silly. I'll skip to why this game is super cool and unique. Essentially, it's a hidden movement game where you are drafting a single hand of movement cards around the table. There's 16 cards, and the start of the round has everyone, even the beast, drafting those cards between them. The cards do a different thing based on whether they are possessed by a hunter or held by a beast. And so you're trying to sort of hate draft towards the beast so they don't get a load of really good cards that are going to make them super mean and terrifying. And it also gives you a rough idea of what the beast can do in any given round, but with enough weird sort of flexibility of misremembering that it's never like a known quantity. The thing that's more interesting though to me is that Beast is a really unusual hidden movement game because it has this rhythm that I've not really seen in other hidden movement games. So a good example of one of our favorite hidden movement games at the moment is Mind Management. It's a game where one person is escaping from a whole team of investigators, and the whole game is one really long cerebral puzzle that ends when the person being hidden is found. It's this one big deduction that lasts for like an hour and a half. Beast, on the other hand, is loads of weird little micro deductions. You don't know where the beast is moving because it's all hidden, but the beast has to reveal itself constantly to like sustain itself and to live. So every round, the beast has a goal, and the goal will be like consume a load of sheep from the board or like eat a guy or something. And whenever the beast attacks, it has to broadcast its location, and it will do it multiple times in a round. So it has this very interesting rhythm where you're doing like micro deductions that then have immediate payoff because the beast has to reveal itself or you find it very, very, very quickly. And it's this, it feels like a hunt in a way that so few hidden movement games do, which is really like brought across by the theme, and it's really brought across by the art as well. I think this is, and we talk about this in the review, this is one of those games that is exactly the kind of thing that Shut Up and Sit Down would have really positively reviewed early on in its life cycle. And we're positively reviewing it now because it reminds us of those kinds of games. The problems with Beast is that it's like a little bit messy around the edges, a rulebook that isn't as clear as it could be, some kind of naff components here and there, and a sort of, it works really well at three players, but not so well at four, and probably not so well at two either. So it's quite particular and quite wonky in places. But the reason we love it is because it just feels so fresh and interesting and weird to play in a way that like so few games have recently. It is a breath of fresh air in being this like odd beast, if you will.
It does sound like an odd beast, but it is also like, there's a really big wince that like flooded over my face when you said that it had a slightly wonky rule book. One of the things about hidden movement games is that everybody has to be on the same page. Like, everybody has to know the rules clearly enough to be able to work stuff out. Because if you miss a bit of the logic because you didn't quite follow one of the rules, or there's an edge case that is unusual, or even if, like, you've got to go and look up or ask a question about a particular rule, it's giving additional information in a way that can really, really deflate an experience. Is it that sort of problem in the rule book, or is it just a bit fudgy?
It could be close to being that kind of problem. And that is a problem we have with Mind Management, actually. Mind Management has a slightly strange layout to its rulebook that makes it hard to reference and learn. And that was probably our biggest problem with that game as well. It's a game where you need, it's a genre where you need a really clear rulebook for everyone to be on the same page. And Beast Rulebook does leave some weird edge cases and some weird interpretations that don't quite make it clear exactly how everyone should be playing, how everyone should be on the same page, etc. However, I think the difference there is that if someone gets a rule wrong in Mind Management, it torpedoes the entire hour and a half of deduction you've just been doing. Whereas in Beast, because the cycles of being found and hiding are so short, those errors get kind of ironed out pretty quickly and they don't matter as much because you're going to have so many opportunities to get in each other's faces and do some damage. I think that's where that wonky rulebook, it's not an excuse for having a wonky rulebook, but it definitely softens the blow.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I think that's a really, really good thing to hear, because one of the things with hidden role games is that you can feel like you only just figure out the mistakes you've made right at the very, very end of the game.
And that's the worst.
That's such a bad feeling. So if you've got chance for a bit of a feedback loop within a game, that makes it so much more accessible. One of my favourite, well, as soon as you mentioned this, I started thinking about Not Alone, which is a game that came out a very long time ago. And I think probably, I think it might have had a written review on the site back, far, far, far back. It is a fairly stripped back, It's not really hidden movement because there isn't a map in there, but it is a beast who is hunting all of the players, and the players decide where they're going to go on an alien planet, and then the beast decides where it's going to go once they've all played their cards face down. And if you go where the beast is, then you start losing, you start taking damage, you start losing morale. And if you don't, then you get to take the goodies from whatever that place is. So it's this really simple cycle of just like, oh, where are you going to go this turn? And how, what have you got the options to? And the beast has a lot of open information. And the back and forth in that is brilliant. And the last game that I had was really, really cinematic because we had this thing where we did really well for a few turns. Really, really well. Such strong setting up of moves and getting there. And we kind of were like, we all kind of like kicked back just a little bit because we kind of knew that we'd won. And then the beast played a card that meant that they just had to get one of us and they would win the game. They would make up the lost ground. And that one of them only had three options for where they could go and was the beast's real life husband. And so the climax of this game was like a kind of like, oh, do I know you well enough to be able to play this game and know where you've gone, despite the fact that any of them were viable, any of them would have won us the game, none of them really mattered at this point. So there was no ludic purpose to what they picked. And the beast just gobbled her husband up, and it was beautiful moment that just like, it was just perfect drama kind of thing. And I think that that's possible with that feedback loop, that kind of like,
yes,
we figured out how to do it, we're learning as we go. Do you think it had some of that cinematicness? Or
I think the beast has, because of how strong the theme is in this game, and because of how, so I'm gonna, you know, I sort of feel like I need to talk about this anyway because it's Quinn's favorite aspect of the game. So one of the most important things about this is there is an arc to your games of Beast, or some games of Beast. We had so many different stories came out of it in a way that I found really satisfying. But a lot of them come about by the fact that your aim as the villagers in this game, as the hunters, is to hunt down the beast and kill it. It's got 4 health or something, or 5 health points, and every time you hit it, it takes one away. You also have health, and the beast can also do lots of damage to you. And this is super weird because the beast doesn't want to normally hang around and do more hits than one. It wants to just hit you once and then run away, because if it stays out in the open for too long, it's going to get cornered by 3 hunters who are going to turn it into a scarf. But the switch that happens when a player has 3 health to when they have 2 health turns the game from like a hunt, you know, it's a real like, you thought you were hunting it and then it hunts you. When the beast like bites back, it can be like devastating and vicious, because the game has player elimination for the whole round. You are out for a whole round of play if you get munched by the beast, which lends itself to these incredibly dramatic moments where we played a game where one of the players was playing a wolf. It was Quinn's. He had, not only was he playing one big wolf, he was also playing a little pack of miniature wolves this big wolf had spawned, who were running around the board causing terror. My partner went into the forest to go and hunt the wolf, not realizing that she was pretty low on health. The wolf then ate her, and then it was just me left, and I had to defend 3 separate towns from this wolf and all of its children, who had kind of launched this almost military operation on all the villagers at the same time. And this moment where, like, I had lost my one partner in this world, and I had to face off against so many wolves, and I was spread too thin, was such a, like, fantastic finale to that game, where the wolf had, like, been this scared creature in the first few rounds, and then reclaimed all of this land in the second half. And that feeds into, like, the theme of the game is, initially, you have a lot of like, you can have sympathy for both sides of it. You know, these humans are in the sort of theme of the game. They have been ousted from their homeland in the theme of the game, but then they have also taken up root in this wolf's homeland. So there's a sort of weird amount of colonialist flag planting going on that makes it murky. You know, these animals are, you know, they are eating all of your people, but also you're in their house. And I think that that means that the stories the game can tell are really like diverse and interesting. And I think that it's good that they left it as murky as they did. And I think it's really interesting. I think it's a fascinating game from a theme perspective. I think the decisions it makes in terms of a really simple stripped back rule set and a really immediate inroad into those interesting decisions somewhat counteracts a wonky rule book and some iffiness at different player counts. Because when we played it at three players, when the game sings, it really sings. And I think that's worth something. That's worth something.
That's brilliant. I mean, like, my main group is three players, and that's a really hard level to find games that really sing at that level, that player count. So that's
I disagree.
Really yeah?
I disagree.
All right, can you give me a list of games that are really good for three players?
Beyond the Sun.
Yeah.
Actually, it's best at two, isn't it, really, Beyond the Sun? Tigris and Euphrates.
Oh, no, can't because of colorblindness, because it's unfortunately the coding on it, the thing on it doesn't work.
Hey, That's My Fish.
I mean, okay, but like, I don't...
Chess.
Oh, God, Tom. That has been a really exciting episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. If I do say so myself, and I mostly say that because...
You can say so
Am I allowed
yourself.
To say that? I actually...
You're allowed to say so
I
yourself.
Really want to play all three of those games. I really want to get that expansion. I think that does exactly what I want it to do to a game that I really like. I want to play Findorf because I don't know what's going on there, and I just love Friedman Fries's parallel universe of Euro games that do not make any sense, but that's okay. Maybe I don't mind. And Beast sounds like absolutely one of my favorite things, which is slightly wonky games that tell really interesting stories. So, like,
it's exactly that. It's exactly
that. Yeah. What a winner. Thank you for talking to me, Tom. Thank you for listening to us, listeners, and thank you for making games, game makers.
I'm sorry if this was a really expensive episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast for you, Ava. I know that we get complaints from listeners when they feel compelled to purchase after an episode. Yeah. And we did talk about, I mean, at least Beyond the Sun expansion and Beast, two real good games. Findorf, jury's out. Maybe we'll have a recap when I send you it.
Yeah, I think you should send it to me, and we can have like a quick, like, 2 minute, like, did Ava like Findorf? And it'll just be me going, not really. Or, oh God, that was amazing, Tom. Oh, Friedman, free, so many apps. Oh.
And nowhere in between.